Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Robert Jervis, who is the Adlai E. Stevenson Professor of International Politics at Columbia University. He is a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is a past president of the American Political Science Association. Professor Jervis's publications include Perception and Misperception in International Politics, System Effects, Complexity in Political Life and Social Life, The Illogic of American Nuclear Strategy, and most recently, American Foreign Policy in a New Era. Bob, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I grew up in New York City.
And looking back, and were you raised there also?
Yes, in Manhattan.
Okay. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, I think my parents, Manhattan, the school I went to, all were important. I mean, the milieu of that time, the 40s and 50s in New York, heavily Jewish, left liberal, not really red diaper baby, that is not communist, but you know, left liberal, that was the dominant view, and involved in politics, if not running for office, but certainly campaigning, talking about it, reading two newspapers a day, arguing, that was the whole milieu.
And you mentioned a school. Was this in high school?
Well, there's school people in the East Coast, ethical culture schools. Mm-hmm. Ethical culturism is Jewish Unitarianism. And the school was not heavily influenced by that. But you know, it was leftist. I remember Pete Seeger coming and singing, "The Banks Are Made of Marble." Mm-hmm. And I can now, you know, I sort of sang along, and later it occurred to me, there's a political message there.
I see. And so did you all, around the family table, did you talk politics?
Oh, yeah.
Or was it just everywhere?
No. Well, it was both. I mean, we certainly talked politics. And whether I caught it from my parents or the other way, I was always interested. My almost first political memory is a false VJ day about a week before the war in Japan ended. And I remember sharply the next couple of years quizzing my parents about what we should do for Cold War things when an American plane was shot down over the Adriatic, saying, well, what should we do? Should we retaliate and all this? My parents probably thought this was odd, but they did encourage it.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you got interested in international politics early.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very early from what was happening in, well, whether I actually read the newspaper at age 7, I don't know. But yes, I mean, the world was so fascinating. And in fourth or fifth grade, a couple of friends and I would put out a mimeographed, people won't know what that is anyway, like a Xerox newspaper, commenting on, I remember, the Slansky trials in Czechoslovakia, mm-hmm. that is, as the Soviets got their hold. I mean, you know, for me, you couldn't escape mm-hmm. the world. And if you wanted to, the world wouldn't let you escape. I mean, friends of my parents were called before McCarthy's hearings. That was a milieu that it was enveloping.
Mm-hmm. And where did you do your undergraduate work?
Then I went to Oberlin College. Mm-hmm. That was, I entered in 58, and I thought, having grown up in a big city, that I really should try a small town. Mm-hmm. No, mistake. I like Oberlin, a very good education, but quite an experience.
Yeah, yeah. And then on to graduate school at Berkeley.
At Berkeley.
I should have said welcome back Bietti.
Yes, it's always nice being back at Berkeley.
I really
love it.
And what brought you, you came to Berkeley in the early 60s?
Arrived in 62.
Right.
And partly, I mean, I had choice of graduate schools, and unlike students today, I didn't know a lot about the places, but I was attracted to Berkeley, part because it was 3,000 miles away from my parents, so I was close to, but still it was away. Depended my college roommate, Andy McFarland, who mm-hmm. went on again to his career in political science, had decided to go to Berkeley, and the fact that the San Francisco demonstrations in, what was it, 60, against
mm-hmm.
UAC?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, or late 50s,
In 59 or 60, you know, I thought that would be an interesting place to be.
Yeah, and when you were here, you focused on international relations, and who were your academic mentors who really influenced you, whether they were an IR or not?
Well, I was really fortunate because I hadn't done a lot of research. In fact, the IR faculty at Berkeley, distinguished in their ways, were not doing stuff that interested me. Mm-hmm. Ernie Haas was, of course, the big figure and towering importance in the field and great integrity. But with all due respect, I just didn't find then and don't find now what he did terribly interesting.
That is his subject matter.
Yeah, the subject matter.
Yeah.
Well, also, it's interesting that he was a reformer. Mm-hmm. Ernie was driven by the deep desire to change world politics. To be honest, I've done a little consulting, which we'll talk about, I hope, but I'm driven to understand it. Mm-hmm. If I could understand international politics in the 19th century, mm-hmm. I'd be happy as a clam. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care what it means now. Ernie wanted to change it and did it in odd ways. But Glenn Snyder was here for a visitor, and I took Glenn's classes, and he was my mentor, and I dedicated one of my nuclear strategy books to him and several others, and in many ways I owe a tremendous amount of my intellectual development to Glenn and the 2 years that we spent together when he was here.
Let's talk a little about international relations yes. theory and doing it. What does it take to do that work yeah. well, in terms of skills, in terms of temperament?
That's interesting. For now, skills is one of the right words. A tremendous amount of the field is either formal, using game theory, and I use informal game theory, but a lot of people do it formally, and a lot do we call large N. That's statistical analyses. So any young person has to learn that. I read the stuff. I can't tell from my expression. I'm ambivalent. It's produced stuff of real value. I think there are real dangers taken away. I think, first, there are a lot of different ways to study. So there's no one method, no one approach. But I think it takes a fascination with international politics. Mm. I mean, every day I either pick up the newspaper or a history book and say, I can't explain that. Mm. Why did that happen? You know, what rules does that violate? And it takes, I think, the combination of thinking about particulars, but trying to think about the generalizations it fits with or can lead to or can contradict. And that playing back and forth between the particular and the general is what I think is certainly most productive for me. And I think it's a constant grounding in saying, oh, wait a minute, am I keeping your theory anchored in something?
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm familiar with your work, and we'll talk about yeah. some of it in a minute, but I'm curious, given this background that you've just described, there must be a fascinating interplay between the theorizing yeah. you do and what's happening in the world or
yes.
what has just happened. Talk a yeah. little about that and maybe give us an example yeah. of that, because I know, you've done a lot on nuclear
yeah.
weapons.
Let me give you two of my favorite. Yeah. One is what I've written about in the Misperception book, in other article about the security dilemma, on essentially the extent to which a conflict can be seen as an irreconcilable conflict of interest in which a defender of the status quo, to be crude about it, has to use threats and threatened force, deterrence, it's called, mm-hmm. versus what I call there, drawing on others, I am not original in this, and in the spiral models, okay. Well, basically, this is what I grew up with. When I asked my parents in 1947, the Russians have shot down this plane over the Baltic, claiming it was a spy plane. How ridiculous that we would spy, of course not. But leave that aside. You know, what I was asking then was the same question, mm-hmm. so that I'm still driven by those questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then can I, let me tell you the story.
I've
written two books on nuclear strategy. I always interested in my first book on the logic of images, very heavily influenced by Schelling and mm-hmm. Saul. So I always interested in nuclear strategy. If you were in IR and you were in that era, you couldn't help it. But I started consulting for CIA in the late 70s, and partly on stuff on Soviet Union. But I had a friend, better not use his name because he could get in trouble anyway, but I'll tell you later, who was in the Pentagon at that point, mm-hmm. a former student. And I went over to see him and said, now, this is not in my area, but I know that the administration is pushing the new missile, the MX. I can't figure it out. Give me the justification.
Mm.
Pulls a paper out of the drawer. I read it, and I say, are you censored? I say, this is a bunch of crap. This is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
So he puts it back. Says, all right. Mm-hmm. Digs down deeper. Pulls out another paper. And I get back to him and said, okay, you know, this is better. It's still no good.
Mm.
Doesn't answer the fundamental questions. And he said, Bob, you have just read the most sophisticated paper in the government on this. This is so sophisticated, it won't leave program analysis in the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here I was 37 years old, you know, I'd studied this. I was shocked. Hmm. I really thought maybe they were wrong, but they knew what they were doing. And on the plane going back to L.A., I was teaching at UCLA at the time, I sketched out the article that was why nuclear superiority doesn't matter that led to those two books. So I think realizing that the government really didn't have a good rationale led me to think about arguments about nuclear superiority, nuclear strategy, in a way that I'd never thought of it before. Now, in principle, I could have gotten there without this silly paper. But, you know, it really, for me, the constant engagement with what are the issues, what do they mean, and then taking it to a level, if you've gone deeper or higher, than you get from the even intelligent discourse.
So it sounds like there's a real continuity in your life.
Yeah.
Because if you were doing this when you were seven,
absolutely,
in the Cold War and so on, and it's really the keeping that momentum.
Yes.
And of course, the subject matter will change. So tell us a little. I don't have all of your books here, but let me show one.
Yeah.
Perception and Misperception in International Politics. What got you interested initially in this whole question of the way we see the world? Obviously, it's pivotal for understanding international politics.
Yes, and I got into it backwards because, again, my interest was the central Cold War arguments. And at this point, 64, when I'm starting this, I'm pretty much of a hawk. But anyway, the arguments on the other side were called the spiral model, were done by social psychologists, built partly on this security dilemma, but heavily on this perception. So to get into that, I was going to rebut them, but it struck me that I thought they were wrong on the Cold War. Now I'm not sure, but that was an interesting topic that IR hadn't covered. Mm-hmm. So then I was led into it in that sort of odd way.
And we have a limited time, but in other words, this I'm curious as to at Berkeley you were getting a very good comparative. Politics education.
Yes.
I know because I know many of the people who were here with you at that time and so on. And so what tends to be your focus in Misperception? Because behind all of this often is ideology, basically. And you were well grounded in that because I know you were reading everything from Louis Hartz to probably Richard Hofstadter and the Paranoid Self. So how do you find what is really important and zero in on that, which is clearly what you're doing?
Well, that's interesting. We didn't do a lot on ideology, but I was struck by the Louis Hartz book that Mike Rogan, a marvelous Berkeley professor, assigned. And I still think Hartz's analysis of America and why it can't see the world right because of its unusual social structure has a lot to be said. And the great thing about Berkeley then, and I hope now, is it left us alone, the graduate students. It didn't tell us what to do. It said, here are a lot of things to read and think and talk about, and we'll help you. Mm-hmm. But you go out and explore. Sort of, in retrospect, looks a little risky.
Yeah. And I was looking at the Perception and Misperception book in your concluding section, and there you say, well, it's hard to really write a conclusion here, but you say empathy for the other side. That is, how do we understand why we're misperceiving or our adversary is misperceiving? We need empathy for the other side. Make assumptions and predictions explicit. Encourage the formulation of alternative images. Don't let interested parties define perceptions and know the common errors of perception. A short list there, very powerful, and it seems like a lot of our policymakers still haven't learned those lessons.
It is funny, I have not gone back and read that. But as you know, what I'm talking about later today and work I've done on intelligence failures, that list is, it'll be on the view graphs. Today it was on the conclusions when I did the postmortem for CIA on why they were slow to see the Shah would fall over 25 years ago. People in CIA, have read the book and the analysts and really like it. Very hard lessons to internalize. But you're right, I could put them right back on the on the view graphs for the Iraq WMD case.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. Now, you are in the field of international relations. You are, I think it's fair to say, a realist.
Yes.
So help us understand what realism is about in the way it sees the world.
Yeah. Well, I think it really is very important for understanding current American foreign policy. Almost everyone, whether they like American foreign policy or don't like it, see it in terms of internal sources. You know, America, we're doing good for the world because we're good internally. Or the people who think that we're doing evil in various ways trace it back to a tradition of American imperialism. You're starting the genocide of the Indians. You know, we can go through, you've had Chomsky on it, you know, we can go through the left-wing rapids. Pretty straightforward. What almost no one does is say, wait a minute, the United States, for heaven's sake, is a state. It is a country in international politics. There is tremendous continuity. U.S. is behaving like a normal superpower, which the world has rarely seen. The core belief in realism is both from the international system and from human nature, unless people or larger entities are checked externally by the world, you know, they will gratify their whims and impulses. Mm-hmm. It's what the U.S. is doing. Mm-hmm. To what any realist from Hans Morgenthau or Thucydides through Ken Walter, from a different perspective, would lead us to expect. And Ken, in a way, predicted this, an article in 91. It leads you to believe, no, maybe not true, that this here, much as I like Hartz and his American uniqueness, the U.S. is neither uniquely good nor uniquely evil. Mm-hmm. It's what Britain did when it had the ability to do it. It's what country, great powers, will do this.
Mm-hmm. So how, let's bring it up to date now, because, I mean, 9/11 and that attack by the Al-Qaeda network really changed us.
Yes.
Now, another question is, did it change the world?
Yes.
So let me hear you bring your realist lenses here and help us understand that.
Yeah, well, the first thing is, it changed George Bush enormously. I know people who argue the other side. If we want, we can go into it. But I think it did, he says it changed him enormously. Here, I believe him. Those people like me and many others who had studied international politics for years, it didn't change us. We were shocked but not surprised. That is, we did not predict the day, the time, the method. We all predicted a large terrorist attack on the U.S. But it did change Bush and American foreign policy. I don't think terrorism is a world-changing. It changes the world because it's changed American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And the way I see it changing American foreign policy is it being one of a number of possible events that triggered the U.S. to do what I would expect a great power to do at one time or another. Mm-hmm. That is, decide to run wild.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing out there to check it. I think this is foolish because I think the terrorist threat is just much less than Bush claims, and that the popular press has it. I think, you know, we're being almost paranoid, or we've lost a sense of proportion on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, well,
and we'll talk about this, but I want to unravel the pieces of this bowl of yarn. And I guess what are the things that you point out in your newest book, which I recommend very much, and I'm going to use it in my class, is called American Foreign Policy in a New Era. I'll put down the pen and hold it like that. And one of the things that you are emphasizing, because we are the hegemon in the world, the sole superpower, that we, because of our military, our economic, and other powers, are always able to act alone.
Yes.
Even if we've previously acted otherwise. You recently, you just a moment ago said that it was about balancing the power. And the reality is no one can do
that
now.
I think that is right. And I know you were talking to Steve Wald a week or two ago. And I agree with Steve normatively. That is, we would like to see the U.S. cooperate more with others. I think Steve sees more of the so-called soft balancing against the U.S. as occurring. I think a little of it is, but I don't expect enormous, because Europe isn't going to unite. And I wish it would, because I would like them to be able to check us, but I don't think they're going to. And then the others all face a big public goods problem. And I don't think anyone, not the U.S. can do everything, but we're not going to face the same external checks that other countries have, and that's very dangerous. And I think 9/11, it was almost like, as I say in the book, an accident waiting to happen. That is, we were in a situation where there were fewer external restraints than ever been true in the world. And I think kind of 9/11, sometime in the next generation, something would have triggered a sort of expansion of American active deployed power in the world as we've seen, and that's exactly what realism would lead you to expect, even if realism thinks this is foolish, bad for the world, and bad for the United States.
And the important point here we should emphasize, because there may be people in the audience who don't know, that you as a realist look at see the world as it is, which is anarchical.
Yeah.
So the relative power you have to everybody else makes a very great difference about what you can choose.
That's right.
What you can choose to do. And one of the ideas that has clearly emerged during the Bush administration was implicit before, namely that we can act by different standards than
yes.
the rest of the world.
Yes, and it's interesting that they have made this explicit.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, this is intellectually honest.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say the Clinton administration, to the extent it had a foreign policy, which was really very slight, they wouldn't want to say that. And Madeleine Albright occasionally came close, but considered bad taste.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, John Bolton is typical of this administration in not only being forthright, but believing that that's good, believing that you should speak the truth as you see it, very unlike normal diplomacy. But that's exactly right. We've said, in effect, preventive war, yes, we can do it. No one else can do it. Not a matter of fairness. We are, as the major power, that's our role.
Mm-hmm.
We take care of everyone's problems, and they're not going to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. We should explain to our audience, preventive war
yes.
means that, although the administration and its documents
yes.
have called it preemption.
Preemptive, yes.
It's really prevent. So
yes.
we can choose the time and the
yes.
place to prevent something that happened that we perceive as a
yes.
long-term threat.
Preemption is short-term. You attack now because you expect you'll be attacked in the next
yeah.
few days. And that has a great legitimacy to it. It is very close to self-defense. Preventive is, there are a lot of bad things that could happen 4, 5, 10 years from now. We are going to maintain the world order that's good for us and good for everyone. So we're trying to rewrite the non-proliferation treaty rules in a way that would make some sense if we could do it, but it's very different from what's written, the sort of equality that's written down in the treaty. It's a very different world they have in mind.
Your book is one of the few books, in my view, and I've read a lot of them, that really lays out the elements of this hegemonic position so thoroughly. And you say this, and I think it's very important. You say that as power expands, and
yes.
you just explained,
yeah.
you know, what that power is unparalleled and unmatched in the history of the world and in a temporary situation, then the statement of interest also
yes.
does. So
yes.
when the bigger, more powerful you are, the more you think
yes.
you have to do.
Yes, and it's a phrase that I'm not sure who first came, but I remember Bob Tucker, a marvelous realist, very theorist of American foreign policy, arguing and others. Again, the heart of realism, partly for structural reasons, no world government, partly, I believe, for human nature. As your power expands, there are more things you're involved in. You know, there isn't a corner of the globe that something can happen doesn't touch on us. There, you know, revolution in Kazakhstan, whoops, American bases there or implication for it. Remember Kissinger in the Cold War when Allende was first elected, and he joked, Chile is a dagger pointed at the heart of Antarctica. And later he said, whoops,
yeah.
you know, and I think I didn't really mean that. That was being too. What's happening in Chile affects the U.S. So everywhere, and it's in a way even more true now without the Soviet Union, because we didn't care about Kazakhstan in the Cold War. It's part of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. You know, where's a part of the world we don't care about? Mm-hmm. Doesn't exist.
And the other element that you add to this equation in your book is that this is also true of fear. That, in other words, you can, I guess you can be more fearful.
Yes.
You can use fear as a way of policy, but then you can spread that fear widely.
Fear, I think, is an enormous driver of international politics. Again, I'd go back to Thucydides, cause of the Peloponnesian War, is the growth of Athenian power and the fear it created in others. What we call the security dilemma, which is the way in which one country increases its power and makes others less secure. I think this isn't the root cause, but it's one of the two or three root causes of international politics. And you really, living in New York especially, but you saw fear and what it did and what it does. I think you saw the Bush administration both feel it in their gut, partly because there were all the stories about nuclear weapons planted in Washington. None of us knew this, but I've heard enough now. I don't know the sources, but they really did believe it. So you really, they felt the fear in their gut, and then I think they did manipulate it for their own purposes. Mm-hmm. No, it's international politics is a great home of fear. And
I want to pick up briefly on this fear, because it must also be important that actually the Pentagon itself was under attack,
yes,
and they did not know if the next target was the White House.
Yes, that's certainly
so. So
the
there's
case.
A personal element
oh,
here
there
beyond
is.
Everything that they had prepared for by all the different roles they had played in national security. So I guess before we go on to talk about their response and whether how a realist would grade that response, I want to ask you, because I want to go back to this business. I want to draw on your education
yes.
here at Berkeley and ask you, to what extent are there elements in our political tradition that make us more susceptible, as
absolutely.
An additive to this broth
yes.
that we're cooking here. Yeah,
I think there absolutely are at least three. One, separation, probably least important but not true, separation of powers.
Mm-hmm.
President always has to persuade Congress, and Ted Lowy, a famous political science, written very well on that. It leads to what Ted called overselling problems and overselling solutions.
Mm-hmm.
The second tradition is our previous geographic isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Very different. We didn't live in world politics until 1945. I think it tends to make us lose perspective more. And there's, I think, more American nationalism and unilateralism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those magnify.
Yeah. Now, I guess, in looking at the misperception book that we were just talking about, some of this is about pulling out to consciousness things
yes.
that are latent and that are not there.
Yeah.
What is the problem in this? Is it the hegemon or is it the American hegemon that has such difficulty in understanding a lot of what we were just been talking about?
I can't fully answer. I mean, my book, I started when I was working on some of these. I remember a conversation with Steve Krasner, who at that point was in policy planning staff.
Who's now in policy planning.
And now he wasn't in Sanity, now he's head of policy planning.
Very
close to Condi Rice. Steve's a marvelous political science
professor at Stanford.
Yes. Unfortunately, I tried to hire him at Columbia.
Right.
Anyway, but I was talking to him in the fall of 2002 when it was clear to me that we were going to invade Iraq. And I said, this is crazy. And Steve got upset. I mean, right? And he said, no, you can say we're wrong, but not crazy. And I thought about it quite a bit. And I think there's a lot to that. I mean, when I say it's crazy, it means it's uniquely to either Bush, and we can come back to that, or the U.S. And what I'd interpret to Steve's one-word thing about being wrong is more what I've talked about so far, that No, it's what countries do in these situations. And I do go back and forth. I started on the uniquely American, but the more I thought, and the more I thought of realism, I came to stress the, if you will, general. And
there's so you're agreeing with Steve.
Yes, I am. I am. Yeah. I think the uniquely the American things, and Bush himself, personality, certainly magnifies it. You know, I'm giving you an explanation I don't like. I've got too many factors explaining the same outcome. Mm-hmm. I think they are both involved, and I do see, though, if you will, the structural as the foundational, but I think there are unique things about the United States that make it even worse. But some of the behavior of the European countries, in a very mini way, a micro way, parallel the United States. Mm-hmm. And the reason I stress the realism is I think so many people see this, explain what we're doing in American terms. And I just think that, not that's wrong or important, but it's a wrong way to start.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've worked a lot on nuclear weapons, and when you we're going to talk a minute about the Bush Doctrine and the failure of intelligence, but one of the things that I think there seems to be universal consensus about is that the fear is of terrorists.
Yes.
With weapons of mass destruction.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, that link between these two phenomena, to what extent is that also driving this fear? And if so, is that legitimate? Is that a new concern?
Yeah, I think it is very important, because what you've got to start with is implicit in what you said, but I want to say it, which is terrorists without WMD, I don't want to say a nuisance, you know, seems like it's debasing the memory of the 3,000 who died. But it is a nuisance. The number of people who died on 9/11 is the number of people who die in less than a month of auto accidents. It's a terrible thing, something you work on, but you know, it's not a driver of American foreign policy. It's a cost of doing business. The only way what you said about the link WMD is right, but isn't all WMD. You really can't do it with chemicals. Anthrax, you can really stop that if you get detectors. It's only communicable biological agents and nuclear weapons. And it isn't even a dirty bomb, because a dirty bomb won't kill many people. Dirty bomb in New York would be terrible for me, because it would ruin what I'm passing on to my children, which is the value of my apartment, which is on Fifth Avenue. Not in a fashionable part of Fifth Avenue, but does overlook the park nevertheless. And it won't be worth anything if there's a dirty bomb. But dirty bomb won't kill many people. It panics people. The real fear for deaths, obviously, are terrorists with real nuclear weapons. And one of the many shames of this administration is it hasn't worked that problem right. The main source of nuclear weapons are loose nukes in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things the Clinton administration did pretty well. And the Bush administration did not put the priority on that, has not put it on. Mm-hmm. That is the linchpin. It is a horrible scenario. But we should remember that even this horrible is nothing like what I grew up with. That is, in the Cold War, if there were a war, the end of civilization. Mm-hmm. Even a terrorist nuclear bomb is, you know, a horrible thing, but it is not anything like the end of civilization. It's probably less than the tsunami, maybe kills fewer people than the earthquake in the subcontinent. I don't in any means want to, you know, say we shouldn't worry about it. But I'm not sure even that should be the driver of American foreign policy. But it sure is, hell is, that one of the top things you worry about.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's look at the responses of the Bush administration to these events, and in particular what became known as the Bush Doctrine. Let's put on our realist IR cap and help us understand what you see as the assumptions of that doctrine, and whether it merits an A or a C or what grade.
Well, there are, I think, several elements, and I want to save one of the most important for last, because several of them fit with realism. And preventive war, I think they've carried to an extreme, but sort of it's a traditional realist thing. Act now while you can, it'll be harder to act later. The unilateralism has roots in America, but is, again, understandable given the structure of the system, the attempt to spread one's form of a form of order and discourage peer competitors, by which we mean not only China but a united Europe, standard realism. I think those were good things that this administration has carried to an extreme. Mm-hmm. I don't think they were needed. I think a more cooperative approach would have done the trick. But the other element is the one that boggles the mind of any realist, mm-hmm. but it's very American, and that is spreading democracy around the world. Mm-hmm. This is anathema to realists. That is not that realists don't like democracy, but they believe the international system mm-hmm. is very important and that countries react to the system, the external environment, much less to their domestic environment. So realists believe, by and large, that democracies aren't going to behave that differently from non-democracies, and also tend to believe you can't spread democracy by force, and also worry if you make Egypt a democracy, you know, be careful of what you wish you may get it. That mm-hmm. is, it's like to be some sort of, quote, Islamic fundamentalism. So, and that, and realists, this mm-hmm. drives realists up the wall, including me.
Mm-hmm. And to help our audience understand this, realists see the units in a way as black boxes.
Yes, billiard balls is the phrase.
Yeah, billiard balls, right.
Absolutely.
And what that means is that the color of the billiard
Absolutely.
Ball does not matter.
That's right.
In winning the game, what matters, and I guess here we'll have to move the metaphor along a little further, is that it's your relative standing, what you're able
yes.
to do to them, whether you're able to balance their power, what sort of threat they pose.
That's right.
But that doesn't matter whether you're a democracy in the Middle
That's
East
right.
or whether you're a dictatorship.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, obviously the schools of thought become straw men, but they're useful straw men because they get in important things. Realists look at the Cold War and said, Soviet Union and the U.S., Soviet Union's immoral deeply, and the U.S. much less so. But their international forms of behavior are very similar. Vietnam, Afghanistan, the nuclear strategy is the same. They use covert action. You know, you name it, their international behavior is very similar. So there's a democracy. I mean, the other side of the coin, Bush says, we must abolish evil in the world. And he said that in the first speech after 9/11. Realists think we're never going to abolish evil. Evil is partly because you don't have to believe our Bible. Most people have impulses for evil in them. DNA, you know, unless we get genetic reconfiguration, that's going to be there. The international system encourages this. And furthermore, the attempt to abolish evil is going to make the world much worse, and democratic regimes do evil all the time.
Mm-hmm. So what are the basic contradictions here in this policy?
Well, yeah.
I mean, clearly we've made clear that it doesn't
yeah.
fit with the way the world works.
I think that the doctrine does have a real contradiction, and I think contradiction does matter. It doesn't bother only us theorists. And I talked to one person who probably should be nameless, who had a mid-level position in the administration, again, in the fall of 2002. And I said, I understand these three elements, but you know, the first one in this security document just been introduced is democracy. And he said, oh, Bob, no one around here takes that seriously. Well, he was wrong. And those things will come to contradict each other out in the real world. Now, most of us were surprised that the U.S. has pushed democracy as hard as we have in the Middle East. And we haven't pushed on Pakistan yet. But, you know, we could easily get to a position where that does contradict the other elements. And it isn't clear how in the next 3 years the administration is going to handle that mixture.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the core of this, once you go down this road, is if and let's use a interpersonal analogy here, if I fear that you're going to attack me.
Absolutely.
And I want to put up, attack you first, yep, or prevent you from doing that. As all of your work in the social sciences would point, we really are very dependent at this point on information.
Yes.
I have to know what it is you intend,
yes,
what your capabilities are, you know, what is the history of the way you've acted toward me, on and on. So as soon as you go to the public and say, this is about weapons of mass destruction,
yes,
and we know that the administration did that, according to Paul Wolfowitz, he told Vanity Fair, we did that because there was the greatest,
yeah,
consensus,
yeah,
in the government. But once you do that, you have to act on information.
Yeah.
And so you have to gather that information, which leads us to the other,
yeah,
big problem here.
Yes, and just as you know, but the background I consult for the CIA. I want to say that clearly because some people think you shouldn't, which is fine, but I believe if you can talk about it, it's legitimate, and I don't want anyone saying, oh, he tries to keep covered what he does. So I have looked at the WMD issue in the Iraqi case, you know, for the CIA, and in fact, most of the story is public and through the government reports that are either a whole or in part declassified, and I'll have an issue coming out in an article coming out in Journal of Strategic Studies that has thing. But when you step back for the specifics on what was wrong, and you, the main thing I think that hits you time and time
why
again,
the information
is
was so bad.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very, very hard.
Yeah.
I mean, that I think has really got to be the starting point. You know, you'd think it's sort of first easy to find a country of nuclear weapons. Well, it isn't. They're trying to keep it secret, mm-hmm, often, or they're trying to bluff you. The North Koreans have said they have nuclear weapons. Do they? Well, I've talked to the people who know the most about it in the U.S. government, and they smile, not because they can't tell me what they know. They can, but because they can't be, you can't be sure. They've said it. I mean, how would you know? You'd know if you had an agent who was high up in the program. You'd know maybe if you had someone who was a technician who'd gone in there and patted the bomb and said, oh, it's warm, okay, there's plutonium in there. It could be an elaborate bluff. You know, it would be, it's very hard to know that. And in the Iraq case, it was sort of all sorts of inner games he was playing, Saddam was playing, that was very hard to penetrate. So you need good information and you can't get it, and decision makers psychologically have to pretend they have it because they have to persuade people and they have to act, and they can't psychologically face up to how little they know.
And you've studied this, and it's very clear that one of the things going on here was that everybody really had the same assumptions,
yeah,
and they were essentially sharing almost,
yes,
the same pieces of information.
Yes.
So we had no B team, no team saying, well,
yes,
let's challenge what's,
yes,
being said, and we had no way to think out of the box. Is,
yeah,
that a fair summary?
It is. According to Hans Blix, the only person he knew who doubted it was not him. He thought they had not as much as the U.S. saying, but serious programs. But the only person he knew about it was Chirac. He said, Chirac and Blix, Chirac said that. Blix looked startled. Chirac said, my intelligence service tells me they have it, but I don't believe them. These intelligence services, they intoxicate each other. And I think that is part of it. And it became so deeply rooted in conventional wisdom that, remember, almost none of the opponents of the war challenged it.
Mm-hmm.
It partly because it didn't make sense. If Saddam didn't have an active nuclear weapons program, why was he committing suicide?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't he not only let the inspectors in, but welcome them, which he didn't, really show them everything? He could have shown that he didn't have nuclear weapons, same way that Libya, when they made the agreement, pretty much convincingly showed what it had. Why didn't Saddam do it? The Delphi report has some answers, not very convincing, but at the time, excuse me, if you'd produced what we, quote, know now and put it on a decision maker's desk, he or she would have laughed. It seems wildly implausible.
Mm-hmm. But was it, I think this comes out of the Delphi report, that he was one element amidst all of his irrationality, was not letting his potential adversaries in the region know what it is he didn't have.
It looks like he wanted, among the things, he wanted to deter Iran. But in the whole scheme of things, this, if I'd been his advisor, I would have said, boss, Iran is third order on your problems. And anyway, Iran isn't going to attack. And if it does, the U.S. actually will have to protect you. So the idea that he would do this to protect from Iran partly shows how cut off from reality he was. So the intelligence made a lot of errors, which, you know, I'll do for the session this afternoon and to my article. But, boy, this was a really a harder one than many of the others. But I think the essential point is intelligence is going to be wrong a lot. And making policy, I say decision makers have trouble understanding the limits of that, because it's very scary to sit, I'm going to make a war and peace decision on the basis of information that's, what, 60% reliable?
Now, there's an irresponsibility here within the political system, if not solely in the Bush administration, in the sense that, well, first of all, if they had said, well, we're going to go in because democracy works, then they wouldn't have needed the intelligence because there was you point that out. So you would not have to have the evidence. Then if you also point out that if Bush had been honest and said, well, look, we really don't know this, you know, but I, because of 9/11, I'm really worried. This is my job. I'm going to, but he didn't do that. So now what they, what everybody in the political system seems to be doing is looking for a whipping boy so that they are not accountable when the next election is held. Is that fair?
I think that is. Now, maybe because I do consult for CIA a number of things, I have perhaps excess sympathy for them. But the Senate report, which really rips them up one side down the other, overdoes it. I mean, there are real things wrong, but the CIA is a marvelous whipping boy. First, it can't fight back because, you know, they're not allowed to go in public. And it's great for Bush. The Democrats can dump on them. Everyone likes to. So yeah, they're everyone's favorite whipping boy. It's sort of frustrating for them.
Now, so let's get you to put on. I want to draw on this picture of yourself that you've shown. You know, asking all these questions and so on, and this big question of the politicization of this decision to go to war, and it seems that what does a an analyst such as yourself looking at this. What was it about the administration and what it was doing that created or a perception of imminent threat? Or was that an impression that they just created, or did they actually believe that? How, even if you don't have the definitive answer, help me understand how you would try to sort this out if you're going to write a paper in a few years.
That's very, I mean, clearly they created the view. They very consciously, as many people went, linked 9/11 and Saddam in ways that were extraordinarily clever. I have a whole file on this. It's really brilliant the way they did this. I think totally dishonest, but really brilliant. Brilliant in the sense that when you say, well, when you say to them Saddam and 9/11 aren't linked, they could say, we never said they were. But they use 9/11 and Saddam in the same sentence. They would make paragraphs that moved from one to the other. I mean, I assign these speeches in my class. It's incredibly powerful political rhetoric. And we know that right after 9/11, the public opinion showed that public didn't see any connection, and that as Bush and his colleagues put out the line, it was believed. So this was an extraordinarily effective selling job. We know also they pushed intelligence hard, not on WMD, they didn't need to. That's where a lot of the critics get things confused. Where they pushed very hard was on this connection. And we also know
the connection
between Saddam and al-Qaeda. What we also know is that CIA said no. No, they mentioned, came back, said, look at this, and they said no. And I believe CIA, and now I said that the national intelligence officer in charge who just left the government, political science PhD named Paul Pillar, who led this, refused to cave. Mm-hmm. They said, there is no evidence for this. The things you point to are dribs and drabs. They're unconvincing. So they stood up to that. But, of course, they couldn't make this public. Did they believe it? I guess where I come down from my psychology, not so much this book, but later book, is what we call motivated bias. They talked themselves into it, mm-hmm. in a way in which I think it will be very hard to unravel what they, quote, truly believed. I have an article coming out in Political Psychology about sort of sincerity of beliefs. It's very hard. I don't think the document trail will tell us, and they won't tell us, and they won't even know a year later what they believed. This is going to be, I think, one of the abiding mysteries of this, mm-hmm. is to how they came to believe what they say. Because I think they'd pass a lie detector test on it, but how they came to believe these things and whether they really believed the Iraq Al-Qaeda connection in the face of large amount of evidence, I don't know.
Is there an element here that in a way they were realists but either misguided or C-plus students? I want to go back to this whole question of, well, if you have terrorism, you have to have a state actually was a patron of the. I mean, so they were coming from that position, right?
I think that's very important. I mean, before 9/11, they paid no attention to terrorism, to the extent they did, it was exactly that, the linkages to states. Their foreign policy was heavily state-driven, and I think that predisposed them to see state sponsorship, and that, although Bush abandoned a lot of his pre-9/11 views, that one may have stuck with him. But really, Iraq remains a mystery, and my terrible fear is that the next generation is going to believe we fought Iraq for oil and Israel. And I do not believe that is true. I can't say I could disprove it. I don't believe it. But looking back, people are going to say, well, it can't have been WMD. They weren't. I don't believe that they believed the Al-Qaeda connection. Could they really believe that we could transform the Middle East, by this? Say, what's left? And I think that will produce, I think it's a bit wrong explanation, and produce a sort of cynicism that isn't helpful. But I bet in 10 years, that'll be the conventional wisdom.
Mm-hmm. To what extent do you, I think what I'm hearing you say when we look at your structural argument about this is these are what one could expect from a hegemon.
Yes.
To what extent was this group, whoever they are, the nationalist conservatives or the neocons, this group of people that Bush gathered around him, to what extent were they a major break with the foreign policy tradition that had developed since the beginning of the Cold War?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. You had my friend Clark, and he's interesting on it. And that it's a mixed picture. I mean, the spreading of democracy does have deep roots in the U.S. and again Wilsonianism, but certain and Reagan was an important part of Reagan. Reagan's view of the Soviet Union changed not as its foreign policy changed, but as he saw the cracks opening domestically. So in that way, I do believe they pick up on this. But there was, I believe, a deep pragmatism in the Cold War, and always a fear that the American public would get too riled up at various stages, and a realization that you moved incrementally and that you didn't try to abolish evil, and in the end, evil collapsed itself. And in that way, I think they are a break. And one of the things, though, that's very hard to understand is Cheney and Rumsfeld, because they're children of that era. And, they're the ones that are particularly puzzling.
Can we bring in your argument from before, namely that internationally, there's no balancer, and then if we take the realist argument and apply it domestically, which may not be appropriate, there's no balancer in terms of after 9/11, no opposition party or group saying no.
Yes, I think that is part, and I think that's why I don't think Gore would have invaded Iraq, but I think eventually, given this, the U.S. would have done things that were most unfortunate. But sort of Cheney and Rumsfeld were both, if you will, experienced in the Cold War and in a way had sort of, I thought, some forms of moderation drilled in. But no, I think it partly is this, it's a situation of, in a sense, combination of fear and opportunity. They did have fear for the, and even if they half made up the al-Qaeda connection, they could at least say, disprove it. Well, you can never disprove it. So I think there was a strong element of fear, and this combination of fear and opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very
ignition.
Powerful.
Ignition, yeah.
Yes.
And so I guess the question is, looking down the road, what? Yes. Where will the balancing come?
Yeah.
I mean, do we wait 20 or 30 years for China to rise?
Yeah.
Is it that there will be a reaction, a kind of an inner balancing within the political
yes.
system? Is that
yes.
where we have to look?
Someone who's it again, Yogi Berra, my favorite one. You know, prediction's difficult, especially about the future.
Yes.
But yes, I think the Bush Doctrine will collapse. I think it is collapsing. There's a very good article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs by John Mueller, who's and if you ever get John out here, you've got to do it. He's just marvelous.
Yeah.
Among other things, an expert on public opinion. He points to the incredible fall in support in the articles titled "The Iraq Syndrome," that there's going to be a pulling in of horns in a way that will be good and will simultaneously be bad. I think that this is inevitable. I think we probably are not going to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. We could set them back another 10 years by bombing. I don't think we're going to do it, but I can't be sure that I think you'll find American public isn't going to support adventures, and you will get, as Ken Waltz would predict, nuclear weapons spreading, because when Iran gets them, others will get it, and that will increase the cost for the U.S. of intervening. I think that's the way, that combination of the U.S. pulling back, others engaging in self-protection and self-aggrandizement. You can argue a world would be better if the U.S. could do a consistent Bush doctrine, a consistent hegemony. Domestically, the U.S. cannot follow that consistent policy. So whether that other world's going to be better than a real Bush world, I don't know. But we can't have a real Bush world. The U.S. domestic system will not support it.
Mm-hmm. On that note, Bob, I want to thank you very much for coming back to Berkeley this week, and also thank you for being on our program. Thank you. And I want to show our audience your book again, American Foreign Policy in a New Era, which I read and heartily recommend. So thanks a lot, Bob.
Well, thank you, Harry. Really enjoyed it.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.